Thanks very much. Hi, everyone. It's nice to be here. What we're going to do for the next hour or so is engage in God talk. It's very hard for anyone to know how to say anything in relation to God. For myself, and this is just my opinion, I'm much better. This is my version of Maimonides' via negativa, where you only ever say what cannot be said about God. It's much easier for me to know when I'm hearing nonsense spoken about God than to hear anything that is easy for me to relate to and engage with. Nonetheless, we are, I want to suggest, impelled to grapple with this eternal and internally elusive question. And the first source that I've brought on our source sheet is a statement from Eugene Borowitz, probably the greatest living Reformed theologian, retired this year in his 90s from active duty in our institution, HUCJAR, on our New York campus. And this is what he has to say in one of his essays. An idea of God set before Israel must meet the criterion of history, past, present, and future. It must demonstrate that it is an authentic development of the Jewish past. It must be logical enough in contemporary terms and standards to make the present generation want to live by it, and its content must be such that this life is recognizably Israel's life of Torah before God. It must also be willing to stand before the judgment of the lives of the generations yet to be. Past, present, and future, the Agadic freedom is given, but the responsibility is great. So any God idea, any approach, any language we might develop, which is going to help us organize in our own minds and communicate to others a meaningful understanding of God, has to stand, according to Borowitz, by these three criteria. It needs to be resonant with the Jewish past. It needs to be equal to the challenges of the present. Okay? We are having this conversation in comfortable surroundings, in the knowledge that in the world, which is always ruptured and broken, over in Nepal, there is abject catastrophe. It's interesting to note that it was a European earthquake, the Great Lisbon earthquake, which gave rise to, in the 18th century, to a great flurry of theological reflection and activity as people ask themselves the question, what kind of God can I talk about and what kind of God understanding can I have, which is not only resonant with the past, but also can exist in the present of which I am aware. And so this is our present includes these catastrophes. It also includes, of course, a world of exploration, discovery, research, understanding. There are now all sorts of exciting ways in which human beings are working out. It's always a good sign when somebody closes the door in there. That's a touching moment. We live in a present in which human beings are engaged in fascinating, exciting, and varied ways of understanding the reality and the truth about them. So a God idea that we're going to talk about must resonate with the past, must somehow be in conversation with and be possible to be expressed in the present. And it must also speak to a future. In other words, I want to suggest it needs to be a usable, an actionable idea of God that can be communicated and understood. Now, I'm not planning in the next 50 minutes to answer all of this. That's actually hard. But what I do want to do is suggest a line of thinking, an idea, an image, a metaphor, which may be fruitful as we, certainly in, for myself, as I try to grapple with a meaningful notion of God. Now, in order to demonstrate that this is not a new activity, I want to bring an example from the writings of Abarvanel, Don Yitzchak Abarvanel, one of the greatest figures of the Spanish Jewish experience, who is engaged in a discussion, and I brought it here in its original language, and we'll tease it out together in the next few minutes, brings a discussion in which a Jew of his present relates to a traditional text from our past. It comes in the Song at the Sea, when we read the bold and triumphant expression, Adonai ish milchama, Adonai shemo. God is a man of war, and God is his name. By the way, for us in the 21st century, there are problems with this that Abarvanel wasn't even grappling with, okay? That's all the man stuff, all right? For him, it was the man of war. Is it theologically plausible? Is it tenable? Is it possible to engage with the idea of a God who is a man of war? And in our tradition, from the time of from the Second Temple literature through the Midrash and thereafter, we see different ways of grappling with this theological challenge. Okay? Here you have Jews of a certain present taking an image of God from the canonical Jewish past and saying, I can't take it at face value. Now, here's the good news if you're a Jew. Taking a text at face value is not the traditional thing to do. Okay? Literal readings of the text, be it biblical or rabbinical, are not, I would suggest to you, what Jewish tradition in general does. Okay? Pshat, the literal or plain reading of the text, is of course an important theme in our tradition, but it's worth mentioning here a Hasidic teaching to the effect that pshat otiot tipesh. The word pshat is comprised of the letters which also form the words tipesh. Literacy and a certain kind of stupidity are never far from each other. And so I want to say there's actually a beautiful idea developed by the great scholar of the Jewish esoteric tradition, Yosef Dan, who says, we're different, our tradition is different than, say, that of Christianity. Why? Not for all the theological reasons that one could rehearse here, but for a language reason. When a Christian reads the New Testament, she reads the words, if she's reading it in the original, a Greek story about people speaking in Hebrew or Aramaic to each other. To judge from Mel Gibson, they're speaking in Aramaic. Okay? That's an impeccable source right there. Now, what that means, as Yosef Dan explains, is that in order to tease out what the Bible means, you have to engage in translation. You have to ask, what is the original valence, the original meaning of the words? That is not a Jewish question. You got to be dangerous. Anybody who tells you what is and is not Jewish, you should be suspicious of them, except for me, of course. Everything I say is fine. But when I say it's not a Jewish question, it's not the primordial Jewish question. Because our sources tell us by and large of the deeds and thoughts and sayings of people in the language, that at least is the way it's presented, in the language in which they thought it and did it and said it. And so our first question is not, what does it mean? What is the valence of X such that it can be interpreted as Y? That's not our question. Our question is not, what does it mean? Our question is, what can it mean? What might it mean? What should it mean? What is the semantic and interpretive range that is available to us as we encounter these words? So Abarvanel, who never read the writings of Yosef Dan, but is thinking in similar terms, asks a question: how are we going to deal with Adonai Ish Milchama Adonai Shemo? God is a man of war, God is his name. And he offers here two ways of interpreting this text, which saves a God concept that he can believe in and engage with. Ve'omnam amru, you with me? It's the second text. This is number two. Ve'omnam amru ish milchama, Adonai ish milchama, Adonai shemo, tirgem bo onkelos, Adonai mari natzchan karvaya. Namely, onkelos, and this is the traditional Targumic approach. Here we have translation going on, not interpretation. God is the master, a victor in battles. Ve'le'inyan hazeh nimshechu kol ha'mefarshim. And most or all of the classical interpreters, says Abarvanel, have gone in this direction. God as a war hero. Ve'le'ot ma'amal megune be'enai, לתאר את השם יתברך בשם איש. But it is a reprehensible thing in my eyes, says Abarvanel, to describe God in terms of an ish, of a person, of a man. That's not appropriate, says Abarvanel. נראה לי לפרש הפסוק הזה באחד משני פנים אחרים. I want to suggest, and this again is a nice Jewish way of doing this, not the alternative interpretation, but a couple of different possible routes. האחד הוא נאמר בתמיהה. The first tool, exegetical tool he employs, is to read this as a question and not as a statement. There is a story that is told in the lore of my institution, the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion, from the days some decades ago in Cincinnati, where there was a tennis court that was made available to students and faculty. And there was a sign on the tennis court saying, "Faculty and students only, no guests allowed." And two students arrived one day for a tennis game and found that the court was being occupied by a Talmud professor who was playing tennis with a guest, not with another faculty member. And they challenged their professor and said, "Well, I'm very sorry and excuse me and I hope you give me a good grade, but, you know, there are rules." He said, "Boys," in those days all our students were boys, "boys, let me teach you how you read a text. This is what the sign says: faculty and students only? No! Guests allowed." In other words, bitmiha, reading something as a question, opens up a whole new possibility for understanding. So this is Abarvanel again, never played tennis at HUC, but Abarvanel has the same idea. Okay? כאומר, האם אדוני איש מלחמה? באמת הוא אינו איש שיעשה מלחמה עם איש אחר, אבל בהפך, כי אדוני שמו טוב ומיטיב ומלא רחמים ואינו איש מלחמה. Could it be that God is a man of war who makes war with other men? You understand, that's another theological problem. Because if God is an ish and somebody else is an ish, then God is like somebody else. And in that case, that's no God. This is just impossible on every count, says Abarvanel. No, the verse is saying, is God a man of war? Of course not. This is God we're talking about, who cannot be, because God is the quintessence of goodness and kindness and mercy, and is not a man of war. אבל כל הרעה שבאה למצרים בתביעתם בים, הם סבבו ועשו אותה לעצמם. He then goes on for good measure and explains that it wasn't that God wrought a victory against the Egyptians, but rather something innate in the actions of those Egyptians themselves, which caused this eventuality. He offers a kind of naturalistic alternative to the miracle narrative, which is the pshat of the biblical text. And since, as I suggested, he doesn't only give one such reading, but he offers another, Hashenihu shebavur shepar'o amar b'mitzrayim, mi Adonai asher ishma b'kolo, lo yadati et Adonai. Okay, so he says you need to read this in terms of the whole narrative of the story. Pharaoh mocks God and says earlier in the text, in the chapter 8, who is this God? What, you know, tell me about your God. He's a nothing. Who is this God? Lord, I don't know this God. Amar Moshe kan ke mehatel mimeno. So now Moses, as Pharaoh is gurgling and sinking in the sea, Moses turns to him and says, you remember you asked that question, who is God? This is God. He says, Adonai ish milchama, Adonai shemo, ve'ish milchama hu toar leparo. This is brilliant. Adonai, comma, ish milchama, Adonai Shemo, God, you man of war, he says, turning to Pharaoh. God can't be a man of war, that's obvious. So these words, we have to do something with them, right? So they're actually being addressed to Pharaoh. God, you warlike man, this is God we're talking about, not your tawdry, petty human categories. Abarvanel is doing theology here. He's asking himself the question, how can I have a God concept which is resonant with the past, which is relevant for the present, and which is possible, or shows the way for a possible future? I've become very interested in the last year or two with language theory. And I want to suggest that one way in which we can find a language, a vocabulary, a way of thinking and talking about God, is to learn a little more and think a little more in the categories of these language theorists. By the way, this is not an original idea. Taking an emerging discipline from a particular time and using it, this is, I want to suggest, an intensely Jewish thing to do. Rather than close yourself off from the world, bring the best of what the world is doing into your own discourse. To give you a couple of examples of important works of Jewish theology that have been created recently, which use different disciplines, I'll mention two books or two thinkers. They each work for sister, you might say, rival institutions to my own, which is just to show you that when you're talking about God, petty denominational and institutional interests should not apply. They usually do, but they should not. The two thinkers I'll mention to you are Brad Artson and Art Green. Bradley Shavit Artson, in his most recent work, is very engaged with the new physics and the new cosmology, and is asking the question, how can we think, it's kind of God and the Big Bang thinking, how does our new understandings about the physical world in general, and most particularly the way in which the world comes to be, according to the scientists, how does that instruct or inform our God talk? And Arthur Green, in his in many of his works, but if you look at Radical Judaism of a couple of years ago, he is, while he doesn't claim to be an evolutionary scientist, he's using the metaphor and the idea of evolution to talk about, and this is an extension of what is often called process theology, to talk about a God in evolution, a God evolving, our awareness of God's reality evolving through nature and in time. Here you have examples of people who live in the world that it's their fate and privilege to occupy, and use the wisdom of that world to understand what might this mean for a God concept that I can use. Now, some, I don't know you folks at all, and I don't know what you read and what you're interested in, but I'm talking here about a bunch of different thinkers. They include, some of them are philosophers, some of them are involved in linguistics, ethnolinguistics. It's people like, I'll now name drop, not for the sake of name dropping, but just to give you a sense. And if you read anything by any of these people, it will not be a waste of your time, although it may give you a headache. Austin, Benjamin, Chomsky, Deutscher, Guy Deutscher, who's an Israeli, a man of Israeli prominence who writes fascinatingly about language. Pinker, Sapir. It's fascinating, without being triumphalist, how many of these people are of Jews or of Jewish prominence. Because I suppose it's not that surprising, Jews have been very engaged in thinking about language for an awfully long time. Saussure, a Swiss, not a Jewish a linguist. Steiner, he's one of ours. Wittgenstein, that's complicated. Okay, Ludwig Wittgenstein, really complicated Jewish story. But this is a list of people, not all dead, all white men, I believe, in this particular, not all currently dead, let me put it that way. But these folks and many other people are writing and thinking about the phenomenon of language. What language is, how people use it, how it is learnt, how it develops and changes in the world. And my current idea, my current project, is that some of these insights and thoughts can help us find a God language for ourselves, those of us who are interested and motivated in doing so. Take a look at source number 3. First of all, I'll take a breath. Any questions, comments, distress signals, signs of life before I continue? Nothing? Everything's just crystal clear? Okay, I don't believe you. Number 3 is from the 7th chapter of the book of Numbers. So the very end of that long chapter. Uvevo Moshe Elohel Moed ledaber ito, vayishma et hakol midaber elav me'al hakaporet, asher al aron ha'idut. As Moses came to the tent of meeting to speak with him, with God, he heard a voice. What does that next word mean? Midaber elav. What does it mean? Right, that's what we're taught. Medaber means speak. But that's not the way that the Masoretes give it its pointing, its nikud. It doesn't say medaber elav. It says midaber elav. And Rashi explains, midaber kmo mitdaber. This is, it says Rashi, in the hitpael form. In Hebrew grammar, what does the hitpael usually denote? Thank you. It's something reflexive. God speaking to God's self. That's how Rashi understands the Masoret's decision to read this word, not Hakol medaber elav me'al hakaporet. That's simple. God is here. That's Cecil B. DeMille. God is here with a big deep voice. Moses is there. There's the tent of meeting. God speaks. Moses hears. Where everyone goes home. No, says Rashi. Hakol midaber elav. The voice is speaking to itself. And what is Moses' role? Umoshe shomea me'elav. And Moses is overhearing God. Not listening to God's direct command. Moses, the ultimate prophet, has the job of overhearing the linguistic or the divine conversation, if one could say such a thing. And by the way, Rashi just did say such a thing, so we didn't make that up. Here you have something which is no doubt an ancient tradition. It goes back, the Masoretes, we know of them from the Middle Ages, but they bear with them traditions that go back centuries and millennia. You have an idea here of God in conversation with God's self. Go back to the book of Genesis and the creation of the world. You have another echo of that, right? God says, I know what, here's an idea. And then the world gets created in speech. Now we're going to fast forward from the Bible and the Middle Ages to a remarkable man, Walter Benjamin. Has anybody here come across Benjamin before? Read anything about him or of him? Sir, what's your name?
Robbie.
Hi, Robbie. What do you know about Benjamin? He was a close friend of Gershom Scholem. Gershom Scholem, the father, really, of the study, modern study of Jewish mysticism, and the teacher of Yosef Dan, who I mentioned earlier. In Germany, Benjamin and Scholem had a close relationship. Luckily for us, it was also an epistolary relationship. That's to say, they wrote letters to each other, and we have them, and they're fascinating in all sorts of ways. Do you happen to know anything about what he did, why he matters? Fair enough.
I just read it referenced in the introduction.
That's good. That's good. That's absolutely great. Walter Benjamin was a remarkable European intellectual who wrote about a very broad range of topics, and it was certainly a true statistic some 5 or 6 years ago that in the humanities more doctorates were being written about Benjamin than about anyone else. He's extremely fascinating to people in politics, in theology, actually, although he was not really a theologian, in social theory, in cultural studies. One topic that I've been very interested in recently, and I published an article about earlier in the year, is about the phenomenon of quotation and citation. And Benjamin is very, very important if you're interested in that field. He's a big deal. He meets a very tragic end, as you can tell from his date, dies in 1940. This is when he gets to Portbou on the border between France and Spain, doesn't think he'll be able to get out of occupied France, and takes his own life, we believe. Benjamin writes a fascinating essay in 1916 called On Language as Such and on the Language of Man. And it really is an interpretation of the first chapters of the book of Genesis. And he is playing with this idea that God creates the world using language, and then in the ultimate act of divine grace, gives up language to humanity. Okay? And here we have a few quotations. I mentioned in italics here that there are all sorts of ideas of language that he rules out or he poo-poos in his essay. There is what he calls a bourgeois notion of language, and that is that you need language for people to be efficient in society. If we didn't have language, you could never ask for a raise or buy a new car or things wouldn't work. Right? So a bourgeois notion of language, as he describes it, is what language allows you to do together. And that, by the way, there is a lot of that in so-called, you know, if we imagine what life was like for humanids or humanoids or whatever they were before language, okay, there's a limited range of activities. Okay, in fact, it's amusing if you ever see movies which try to represent, you know, cave, what should we now describe as cave persons, okay, they inevitably end up using a kind of language because we can't imagine people living in proximity without using language. It's just that they say things like, you know, ag-ag, or if you go to another version of that, primordial man, they say me, Tarzan, you, Jane. Right? In other words, they do all exactly the same things as we do with language, just with slightly clumsy grammar. Okay? Because that's the only way we can imagine what it must be like to live as a person and not have language. There's another version of language which he also rejects, which is the mystical version. Okay? And what he calls the mystical version of language is that in which words are tools which you can do miracles with. This is true, by the way, in many, many ancient and traditional societies. Words have power and mystery, and if you know somebody's secret word, for example, their name, think again of our tradition. If you know somebody's real name, you then exercise all kinds of power over them. But Binyamin is not talking about language as a prop for efficiency in society, and he's not talking about language as a magic wand to do miracles. He's talking about something else. Who wants to read from where it says God's creation is completed? Who is prepared to read, if I ask nicely? Who doesn't want this silence to continue? Please, thank you. Just tell me your name.
Melody.
Hi, Melody. So this is Binyamin. Nobody ever reads Binyamin, you know, last thing at night before dropping off for a comforting night's sleep. It's not easy, all right? But here I think is what's being said. God doesn't create and name man through words. What does God create through words according to the Bible? The world. And as part of that, there is a kind of summit of that creative process. There is Adam. Who does the first naming? It's a human activity. Actually, Adam and Chava. Chava is actually big on naming too. It's understood in Binyamin's version. There's more than one way to read the Genesis account, but this is his version. God creates a world, and God's creation, the human being, uses or mirrors or echoes this creative power in what? In language. The language of an entity, I'm reading from the middle of the page, is the medium in which its mental being is communicated. The uninterrupted flow of this communication runs through the whole of nature, from the lowest forms of existence to man, and from man to God. In Binyamin's understanding of the world is constantly talking to us. Not just, okay, there's a big question amongst language theorists, this goes back for centuries, do animals speak? Do animals use what we would call language? That's a big, big issue, all right? Is it the case that if we could, I mean, this is a kind of a Dr. Doolittle moment, right? If you could actually understand what the birds are cheeping to each other, then it would be a language just like Dutch, and perhaps more readily understandable, okay? Binyamin puts that to one side and says, the world, both animals, but nature, flowers, trees, for that matter, all the evidence of human activity we see around us is speaking. And he describes it as a flow of language that goes through and up to humanity and then on to God. Man communicates himself to God through name, which he gives to nature, and in proper names, to his own kind. And to nature he gives names according to the communication that he receives from her, For the whole of nature is imbued with a nameless, unspoken language, the residue of the creative word of God, which is preserved in man as the cognizing name, and above man as the judgment suspended over him. What Benjamin does in this essay, and we're not going to spend lots of time trying to unpack it, because it would take a different context to try and do that. But what you have in Walter Benjamin is one of the great theoreticians of modernity, of our modern condition, who is, he's not a conventional believing dati kind of person, that's not him at all. But he sees in this story of God creating a world through language and then bestowing in some way the power of language upon us, he sees a big story about the world, about the cosmos, being told. Now, I want to say something, again, questions, comments, anything about, please, just say your name to me, please.
Sarah, hi.
Hi, Sarah. Well, it's a great question, and it's not at all clear that Walter Benjamin was a three times a day praying kind of a guy, okay? Let me give you a response from a different discipline. If I say as a scientist that everything in the world, okay, you can't have a conversation which doesn't involve talking about a table. It's a rule. If you're doing anything with philosophy, a table has to be, it's like you have to do it. So it's this table, okay? If I can demonstrate that everything which has matter in the world bears within it a residue of the Big Bang, okay, I am, and that's how the table got to be here. But where the table is going in the future is back into that great continuum of stuff, of matter, all right? Am I saying that creation is a dead letter in the world? No. I'm describing a process, which is very much what Benjamin tries to do in his essay. He is not writing here a piece for conventional believers. I'm a believing Jew looking for a way to do in my day, this is an immodest thing and it's a very bad example, but I appreciate the instinct of Abarvanel. I don't have Abarvanelian pretensions, but I think that's what we're called to do. So can we take some of this language and vocabulary and think how it might inform a God concept when I say can work for us, that sounds a bit too utilitarian. That is true. Now, here are a few other things I want to say about discourse about language, which is why it crosses my mind that it's so rich and informative when we're talking about God. Here's a big question about God. Is God out there or in here? Turns out, that's a huge question about language. Okay? Because language is, where is language? Where does language live? Well, it clearly has to live inside each person who's got the equipment to access it and use it. But it clearly doesn't exist only inside the person, as various experiments and tragic experiences have proven when somebody grows up without access to discourse with someone else. Is God bounded or infinite? Well, language is clearly bounded. There are different languages. I'm not suggesting that God is, you know, Hebrew or Serbo-Croat or a particular language. I'm trying to say that some of the things we know about language in general mirror in some ways discourse we have about God. So language offers an infinite combination of things that can be done with it, with a very limited set of tools. Think about it, it's kind of weird, right? 22 letters, 24 letters, 26 letters, most alphabets, there are some languages which are outliers in this regard, most languages offer a very, very small palette of tools and then an extraordinary range of what might be done with them. Is language ever living or ever dying? I want to say a word about that. You know, one of the things that a man like Guy Deutscher talks about brilliantly in his work is what happens in the evolutionary process of languages. What tends to happen is that there is an ever unfolding tendency towards abstraction. So we will use a term which talks about something very practical, but over time, the original practical context of the term is lost, but we keep on using the term. We can take some examples. If you have any examples, I'd be delighted to hear them. I'll give you a couple. If I say in Hebrew, nonetheless, this is what I say. Af al pi chen. Now those words, at some level, at some point in their development, mean nose on mouth, yes. That's not what they mean today. But what's happened to the term, the context is lost, but we use the phrase, it gets itself into our language. And by the way, that's not only true of phrases, it's true of words themselves, which originally have a certain kind of context. You can see it in our contemporary use of language. When we reconvene in 200 years, okay, there are a couple of different things that might have happened to the word hashtag. One, which is my own personal preference, is that it will have disappeared from the world. The other is that it will mean something quite different than Twitter, which nobody, believe me, will have any. That will be something that birds do. It's my prediction, although most predictions about language are wrong. What happens in language systems, apparently all language systems, is that things move from the concrete to the abstract. Adonai ish milchama. That's concrete. No. Adonai ish milchama. Or, in version 2, Adonai ish milchama. Adonai shemo. There is a movement out towards abstraction. Here's another thing about language, about God and about language. Most of us are not really capable of thinking about God outside the categories that we've been taught from an early age. Similarly, most of us can't think in language terms unless we know the language. That's one good reason to know a few languages. Not just because it helps you, you know, at customs, all right, help you order things online, but because a language is a way of looking at the world. The scholars of language point out that many of our assumptions, for example, there are languages which we mistakenly call primitive, which is the ridiculous thing to say about any language, apparently. There are languages which have a very different concept of you know, we have first person, second person, third person, and we have singular and plural. That's actually not universal in language. So there are some languages which have a word for me, a word for the two of us, a word for the people who live in our neighborhood, and a word for everybody out there. Why is that less plausible? It actually isn't less plausible. It's what a certain iteration, a certain structure, in response to the culture and the world around, has created. So I want to suggest that thinking about the way language develops may help encourage in us a certain degree of humility and modesty, that we actually know all that is to be known about stuff. What you are doing when you sit every day and study these sources in this place is, amongst other things, learning a certain language. Okay? Learning a way in which our people, or some people in our people, have tried to understand and express big things about the world. Do you need to believe that this is the only, the ultimate language? We have some of those traditions, by the way. You can find it in Jewish sources, which will tell you that God speaks Hebrew and the world was created in Hebrew, and Hebrew is the ultimate, or the Ur language, the primordial language. I don't feel that need. For me, the idea of spending a life of Torah trying to master a language and live within a language, that's quite enough of a life project. Claiming that it's the only language there ever that ever matters, that seems to be a pointless activity. Somebody was going to say something, please. So that's a great, so the question is there Lashon Kodesh? Okay? I want to suggest that Kedusha, sanctity, holiness, is often understood in our sources actually as a human category. Okay? It involves something that we agree about. That is what, there's a whole discourse, a halachic discourse, about when and under what conditions you can sell off whether it might be a Sefer Torah, whether a synagogue, that which was hallowed ground, whether it will no longer be. And there's an element of communal agreement that bestows or unbestows sanctity. So there certainly are words in most languages, okay, which have a special sacred role. Okay? That's not an argument. The question that I was raising is it indeed a plausible claim that God has linguistic preferences? Okay? And that's not where I am. Okay? It's enough for me to note, as I did before, that part of what has characterized Jewish culture for three millennia has been an intense engagement with just about anything connected to language. Here's another thing which speaks to a denominational difference or a difference of the way people act and be in the world. Is language about rules or is it beyond rules? Everywhere you go, there are the language police. We don't have this in the English language, but you know many countries, including the State of Israel, has an academy, the French do this famously, whose job it is to say what is and is not a word. Again, from the point of view of most scholars of language, completely bonkers. Because what happens in language is that things are usage sets tomorrow's rules. So I was taught Hebrew in such a way that I do flinch when somebody says shalosh dvarim. Because I know, according to rules that I was taught, that one should say shlosha. I also know that in the Hebrew that I was taught, one should say shalosh drachim, which makes it very unnerving where I read the Mishnah, where it tells me that ha'isha niknet b'shlosha drachim. Because it turns out that they had a different rule as to what the endings and agreements of numbers and nouns are. Rules actually don't fall out of the sky. They emerge as language, as culture, as religion, as life takes place. Does that mean we all get to make our own rules? No, because then we'll be speaking a language to ourselves, probably in a prison cell. But does that mean that rules have absolute immutable, unchanging valence? I'm not so sure. Rules come from somewhere. They have a life. They weren't always there. Okay? And although that, and I think part of our job as responsible, ethical human beings is to work out how we live in relation to these rules. There's a verse in the book of Psalms which has become famous because it's the prelude to the Amidah. Adonai sefatai tiftach ufi yagid tehilatecha. Let me suggest, let's do a little bit of a Barvanel. Adonai sfati. God is my language. Tipatach, develop. Ufi yagid tehilatecha. And then I will be able to speak your praise. That's not a literal reading of the text. Because there are things more important, this I learned from our tradition, more important than a literal reading of the text. For example, a possible, a resonant, and necessary reading of our texts and of our past. In the mystical tradition, there are many who have noted that the term for circumcision is Brit Milah, and that Lamul does indeed mean to circumcise, but Milah means not only circumcision, but also word. Brit Milah is not only the covenant that a Jewish parent brings their child into upon birth. But our covenant with God, I want to suggest, is in this sense also a Brit Milah, a covenant that lives in language. There are many words in our language, in Hebrew, which are connected to language, and they usually are designated by or characterized by their ambiguity. I'll give you one more example, and then we're going to bring this towards a close. What is Noah's Ark called in the original? What's the Ark? Teva. That's another word for a word or a letter. At different times in the development of Hebrew, it has meant either a word or a letter. When Noah is commanded to make a tzohal for the teva, a skylight, for remember that's towards the end of the flood, to find out if it's okay to go out. In many Hasidic readings of this, this is understood as a commandment for any Jew who prays, or I would suggest any Jew who's interested in looking for God. You need to make a skylight into the Word. We need to reflect about the extraordinary miracle of language. Any of you who have younger siblings, I don't think there are too many parents who've had this experience from that perspective, but if you've ever had a chance to see how language development takes place in most kids, not in all kids, but in most kids, it's just kind of mind-boggling. The researchers still can't quite work out what happens in that there's a certain period of exponential growth of vocabulary and the capacity in language. What happens there? What is it about our hardwiring, if you follow Chomsky, or some other explanation if you go with someone else, which makes it possible for a person, as they're growing in the world, suddenly to be able to do an enormous amount of things with language? My suggestion, and that's what I've tried to do in this hour, is to suggest that if we seriously want to engage in God conversation, we need to get away from banal and silly God conversations, right? What I'm calling banal and silly, of course, is anything I don't agree with, all right? But also, what I'm trying to say is, if you frame the conversation as, does God exist or does God not exist? It is a very limiting way to engage in the conversation. If you want to ask the question, where is God when the world is crumbling in Nepal, and you can give any example you want. We have almost endless examples of this. If you turn this into a binary question, either there is a benevolent God with a master plan who's decided that people should suffer for some greater good, or there's no God and it's all absurdity and just molecules colliding with each other. If those are your only two options, you are very limited in your religious discourse and development. I want to suggest that we listen to the invitation of our tradition. And that is an invitation to be part of Brit HaMilah, a covenant of the word, which invites us to look for God, to express God in this unfolding miracle of language. It doesn't answer all the questions. What does this God command us to do? What are our ethical and ritual imperatives? Okay? What does it mean to pray? That question was asked beautifully just before. It doesn't answer any of these questions. But in my defense, I never said I was going to answer all the questions. That would take at least one more hour. So that's my presentation for this Shiur Klali. If there are any responses or questions or comments before we close this up, please. It is. It's there are all kinds of interpretations to do with the Zohar. It often it appears in a context of prayer. There are lots of words, okay, and you can just recite them. But your job is to let the light shine in on them, to illuminate them, okay. And the way in which the teva is illuminated, if it's from outside or inside, that's a whole other kind of thing. But that's where I first encountered that Hasidic reading of Tzohar HaSeila Teva.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I'm curious, though, about sort of the other side, arguments, the other side being anything that sort of inclines itself towards normativity or rules. Because if you look at what we discussed in Abarbanel, you do have sort of a spinal cord of this is what I believe God needs to be conceptually, and I'm operating in response to that. And even as you sort of jokingly talked about, this is a unquestionably Jewish idea or Jewish concept, you're also operating off of some sort of normative rule of identity. And I'm guessing, and I want to ask you, if this can't all—I mean, because I think a lot of linguistic theorists would have us buy into the idea that this can all be improvisation. And I do think that we've sort of implicitly admitted that it can't. And I wonder how you even start to have the conversation about what are the uncompromisables, what are the rules, what is the academy in the sky saying, like, this is a grammatical structure or a ritual structure. That can't be interpreted away. How would you embark on that conversation?
A couple of thoughts. Great question. A couple of thoughts. Take your metaphor of a spinal cord. A spinal cord is not normative in the sense that somebody posits that you ought to have a spinal cord and that you agree with that thesis and therefore you act as if you have a spinal cord. No, you have a spinal cord if you're lucky, okay? And if you don't, you're going to keep on falling over. It is not something that is brought into being by a fiat, by an announcement. It is something that is organically present. And it's worth taking the example not of language in general, but languages. consider the existence of all these different languages and language systems. Okay? When I was at university in my first year, I lived next to a Welsh nationalist with whom I've stayed friendly, which means I, and I'm boasting here, get Facebook posts in Welsh, which is very cool, although a little difficult to understand. I only use that as an example of sometimes you have to fight to keep an embattled language in business. But it is remarkable how languages seem to display all kinds of aspects of structure without them necessarily being imposed or policed. Now again, I work for an institution, okay? I actually make rules and make decisions about rules, and there are things that you can do if you're my student, which means you'll no longer be my student, okay? And we have booklets and manuals and handbooks. I do not ascribe to them, however, divine valence. I think of them as books and handbooks and manuals which decent women and men trying to do a good job have come up with as a current expression of what our rules of engagement and behavior are. I tend to be suspicious of bold and extravagant claims that the book I'm holding, the manual I've got, not your interpretation of it, by the way, that's completely wrong. That's the real business. That sounds to me like a spinal cord that somebody made up, as opposed to a spinal cord that's there keeping your back up. Thanks very much, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here.